Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the University of Central Florida, offering their Master's of Science in Data Analytics program. Designed to enhance skills in data analysis and machine learning, the new Artificial Intelligence track offers specialized courses to deepen understanding of AI technologies and their applications. More at ce.ucf.edu/data.
It's called Growing Boulder. Of course, you know that. I'm Mark. That's Bill over there. Just give us a few minutes, folks, and you'll see for yourself as we bring in world-renowned experts, best-selling authors, and ordinary people who are living extraordinary lives.
Man, Mark, you are so right about that. And in the next hour, folks, you're going to hear from a former NPR commentator who talks about the perils of dating when you're over 50. Also, a man who's had a great life despite dealing with Asperger's finds out how tough it can be when his son has it too. Then a former supermodel who's created Boom, her own line of makeup just for boomers. Are you ready? It's time to start Growing Boulder. Rolling Stone magazine called her one of the greatest singers of all time. The New York Times said her Thunderbolt voice is as embedded in the history of rock and roll as Eric Clapton's guitar or Bob Dylan's lyrics. But you have probably never heard the name because she is a backing vocalist.
That's about to end, folks, because now for the first time, the spotlight is finally shining directly on her thanks to a great documentary film called 20 Feet from Stardom. She sung with Sam Cooke, Dionne Warwick, The Beach Boys, Elvis, Tom Jones, Sonny and Cher, too many to mention. She is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the author of a fascinating autobiography titled My Name is Love. Let's say hello to Miss Darlene Love. Hey, Darlene.
Hey there. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. I love the My Name is Love. It kind of sounds like Bond, James Bond.
You know, it's wonderful, but when we got ready to put the book, you know, by my last name being Love, we couldn't think of anything to say. But they're always confusing me with the crystals, Bobby Socks, and the blue jeans. So in the meeting, someone just came up with, well, why don't we say her? Just that our name is Love.
it's a memorable title, and let's go back very quickly, if we can, to when you were just a young girl. How do you go from singing in church to becoming a recording artist before you were even out of high school?
Well, you meet great people. That's how you do it. I met the group, the Blossoms. They were already a group while I was still in high school, and they were being coached by a guy that was their manager, but he was also an arranger, and they started doing sessions, and I was with them the first time they ever had a recording session. Someone asked him if he knew any singers, and he said, yes, I have some singers. And that's actually how we started with our very first session with James Darren.
And it's incredible. How come you ended up like staying as a backing vocalist instead of moving up to lead?
Well, for one thing, I was making a lot of money. And I didn't have to go anywhere but to the recording studios to make it. You know, we didn't have to spend any money on gowns and bands and different traveling all over the country. You could stay in one place and make great money. And that's the decision that I had made later on. But as time went on and ladies get older and they get grown and everybody has their own ideas about what they want to do in a group, and a lot of friction started happening, and then I decided, you know, maybe I need to be a solo artist. And that was the decision I made.
You're going to step out front. You know, I think when a lot of people think of their favorite bands, they can name every player in it except the backing singers. Are backing vocalists kind of the Rodney Dangerfields of music? Do they get no respect?
They do, but they don't. The respect they get is from the people they're working for. Like when the people could hire the Blossoms, they thought they were hiring the greatest background singers there were. And they would introduce them on stage, but people come to see the artist, not the background singer or the band, even though they know it sounds really good. And everybody really knows that when you hear a record playing, you sing the hook, which is what the background singers sing. Like on the Do Run Run Run, you sing the Do Run Run Run,
the Do Run Run Run.
And whatever the lead sing, you let that go by, and you sing along again. The Do Run Run Run, the Do Run Run.
Man, Darlene, not only do
but
you...
that's the hook in most background singing. We, the background singers, sing the hook.
Now, you just proved a point. Not only did you sound great and do you sound great, you're also a pretty attractive woman even now, Darlene Love.
Oh, well, thank you.
And
I try hard.
You know, I'm wondering about this, though. I'm guessing that back in the day, you were even more irresistible. Did you ever get, you know, the elbow from some of these big stars you were singing with?
Oh, yes, a few. Wow. I had a few come my way. But you know what? If you don't, then something's wrong.
Hey.
You're calling it the elbow now, huh, Bill?
I just know it's not unusual to be beloved by anyone.
You know, Dar...
One, two.
Bill brings up a good point. You know, I would guess that a background singer in the studio, obviously you got to have a great voice, but, you know, background singers, they do catch our eye, on the stage in performance. You got to have some good moves. I mean, you got to be fun to look at, don't you?
Yeah, and you know, I also had a name as a background singer even while I was out on the road, because working with Phil Spector in the 60s, I had a couple of hit records, but I still went out as a background singer. And if we were working with Dionne Warwick or with Sam Cooke or with Nancy Sinatra or whoever, they would introduce us and they would tell the audience who we were. But see, that's just one audience, you know, and that's not enough people to really get to know who the background singers are. So, you know, it's taking this movie that's out now to tell people who these great background singers are.
And look at you, Darlene Love. The whole point of our program here on Growing Bolder is exactly what's happening to you. Here you are, you've had this incredible career, but now here you are, I think, are you in your 70s now?
I turned 72 this year.
You know, and you're vibrant, you're attractive, you're still singing, you're having the best time of your life.
This is the best time of my life, because all of the worries and cares that you had as a young adult or growing up with children, my children are grown now. I have a fabulous marriage. I've been married 30 years next year. And life is not as hard or, say, complicated as it was 30 or 40 years ago. So, you know, it's all about me sticking to my career, making that 20-foot march from the back to the front, and just my eye is on the prize. It's on this career, and that's what I do now. And it can be done by anybody at any age. I work out every morning at 5 o'clock. I do kickboxing, and there's a lady at one of my classes that's 80 years old, and she's been working out for like 30 or 40 years. So it's not like you can't do it. You do it through your aches and your pains also.
Folks, are you catching this? We're talking with Darlene Love, 72 years old, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one of the greatest background singers of all time, now stepping up and doing her solo thing. And you know, Darlene, as you look back on your career, was there any one group, one performer that you most enjoyed working with?
Yes, actually it was Sam Cooke. He just had so much going for him at the time. And he was so positive in what he wanted. You know, he would tell you it wasn't just about his singing career. He wanted to bring other artists to the front fold. Nobody was actually producing their own singers at that time. Somebody like a Sam Cooke, he went into the recording studio and recorded other artists. That's what he wanted to do. So there's other things to do, and you have to kind of think about that as you get older. Think of something else to do, not just singing, but I've been really blessed to be able to be in great movies and be on Broadway. So, you know, you kind of have to look around and see all the other things that you can do, not just singing. It has to do with singing, but there's other things you can do with your life.
Ego could have derailed you, Darlene, from the beginning, but you pushed it aside to follow what you were passionate about, and look where it led you.
Well, it had a whole lot to do with people that says you can't do it. You're too old and you're not. And I have a lot of faith in God that he has given me this talent, and he meant for me to use it as long as I could. And as long as I feel the way I do, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I have a young mind and a young heart, I figure I can do this as long as I want to do it till I'm in my 80s, whatever. If I feel I want to do it, I should be able to do it as long as I want.
Hey, Darlene, what do you think about what's happened with the music industry and reality television now? I imagine this would have forced you to come to the front 30 years ago if they had American Idol or The Voice, you know, because there's a lot of background singers now that are using that platform to get the attention they finally deserve. Do you like what's happening?
I like a little of it, some of it, because I think a lot of times the choices that they make when they choose the winner, they throw them out there after millions of people have seen them, and you know they have no stability, you know, of a background where they started from. You know what I mean? I'm talking about the younger kids today. I'm not talking about the singers who've been singing background and decide to go on those shows. But, you know, they need help along the way, and you need to fall down and get back up, fall down and get back up. And they don't have the chance to do that after they've won on those shows. You know what I'm saying? So they have nothing to fall back on unless they have a strong family union.
And I guess, too, like some of those people, those are just people that have a talent, but you have a gift and you're an artist because you have a craft. We talked about, you know, seeing you on stage on shows, but people also forget when you're in the studio recording with these guys, it's so different for a backing vocalist, isn't it?
It is. You know what? You have to have a good ear and you have to be humble. You can't, even though the Blossoms knew we were the greatest background singers, when you choose us, you chose the best. But you don't go in with that attitude. You go in wanting to learn, wanting to do what they asked you to do, and you don't overstep. You know, you let them come to you and with the accolades and tell you how great you are and all that. And it becomes a great job for you. You have to have a good ear. You have to be able to blend. We laugh all the time because I sang with Sonny Bono years ago and with Cher, and I would tell Phil, if you get Sonny out here, you know, we could get through with this.
Hey, Darlene.
But, learn how to blend and make him sound good.
Yeah. Hey, in our last 15, 20 seconds, what's the takeaway? What can we learn about life from you?
You know, you have to take it one day at a time. And I'm truly mean, when you wake up in the morning, you have to feel, wow, this is another great day. Something I can do wonderful for somebody, for myself, or for my family, or for my friends. And you have to take it one day at a time. You can think about the future, but you still have to take a step one day at a time and see what that day presents to you.
You know what you are? You are a true superstar, a woman who let her passions lead her to a career that gave her a big part in some of the greatest music of our lives. Hey, if you get the chance, check her out in the documentary 20 Feet from Stardom, and also check out her book, a great autobiography that she wrote called My Name is Love. She is Miss Darlene Love. Up next, she became a supermodel at the age of 50. Her secrets to looking your best at any age.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest. We're going to go back to the 1970s for a minute because that's when our next guest started as a celebrity makeup artist. But even then, in an era of foundation, rouge, and of course the blue eyeshadow, she's always emphasized a clean, natural look. And then her life took an additionally inspiring twist later when at the age of 49, she became a Ford agency supermodel. She did it by not covering up her age, but by embracing it in a way that made her a pro-aging sensation. I'm sure you've seen her ads for any number of clothing stores. She's done countless magazine covers like Oprah, Glamour, and Mademoiselle, all the time being a makeup minimalist. She even has her own line called Boom. So let's say hi to Cindy Joseph. How are you, Cindy?
I am very good. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, sure, but I've got to hit you with this one right off the bat, too, because everybody, Cindy, everybody knows you can't look young without caking it on. And then here you come insisting there's a better way to do your makeup.
Well, actually, the truth of the matter is, the more you cake it on, the older you look.
So why do we do it? You see it all the time.
Well, that is the question.
Yes.
Women are judged by how they look more heavily than any other aspect of their life. And then we're told that our looks disappear, go away, we're over the hill, starting at about age 30, 35. So women are led to believe that their value goes down as their age goes up. And we want to be valued, adored, loved, and flirted with our entire life. So we do whatever we can to look as young as possible for as long as possible. And the truth is, it doesn't work. Everybody knows how old you are, no matter what you do. And number two, there is a beauty at every age, not just in our 20s and 30s. We just turn into a whole nother kind of beautiful each decade of our lives. And when women start celebrating, not accepting, but embracing and celebrating their age, then society's viewpoint will follow suit.
Well, I can see why people, I can see why they love listening to you, Cindy, because that's great. It's very empowering. And your story is really interesting, too. And you've, like anybody else, you always wanted to look your best, but you kind of always had this love-hate relationship with makeup. Is it true that you got so frustrated back in your high school days that you threw all your makeup away?
Well, that's exactly right. I was addicted to makeup. And on one hand, it was just fun. I liked the stuff and the goo and the cream and the colors and all that and playing with my friends. But a big part of it was I looked in the mirror and I did not see what I wanted to see. So I taught myself every technique I could to change the way I looked. And when I kind of got a little older and woke up and smelled the coffee, I realized this is completely absurd. And I just threw it all in the garbage and said, that's it. I became an au naturel flower child of the 60s in California with no makeup at all. And then I reached a happy medium, you know, a few years later and thought, okay, I really feel good about shaving my legs.
Yeah.
But I don't feel good about altering myself to the point that you couldn't recognize me if I didn't have makeup on. And I thought, you know what? I want to infiltrate the very business that sort of convinced me that I did need to do that, or at least, you know, I felt that way, and got right into the heart of the fashion industry.
Now, how does that happen, Cindy, at the age of four? Is that true? You were 49 when you became a model?
When I became a professional makeup artist, I was much younger. I did makeup for about 27 years before I started modeling.
You even catapulted up to, you were at the top of your entire profession as a makeup artist.
Yes. I traveled the world. I worked with all the supermodels and celebrities of the time. I had a wonderful career, enjoyed every minute of it, worked with wonderful people. And one thing I want to make really clear is I'm not against makeup and hair and whatever women want to do to themselves, but I just say pay attention to what's motivating you. If it's fun and pleasure, go for it. If it's fear that's motivating you, then you might want to take a second look and consider what you're doing.
Wow. Great stuff, Cindy. Let's go back to this part where you become a model at 50. How does that happen?
Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather because I'd been in the industry for so long. I knew what a model was. And when I looked in the mirror, I certainly didn't see an 18-year-old girl about 18 feet tall and about 18 pounds. So I was approached on the street, totally out of the blue, by a casting agent asking if she could take my Polaroid because she wanted to bring it in. They were casting for this Dolce & Gabbana campaign. And I thought it was a joke. I looked around the corner to see if my friends were playing a trick on me. And once I understood she was looking for, you know, an older woman to put in this couple with a younger guy, I said, okay, take my Polaroid. And that was it. And they called me the next day and said, you're on, girl. And it literally launched my what's now 14-year modeling career.
It's incredible. And you are everywhere. I mean, when people see your photo, they'll say, oh, my gosh, I remember her from this or that. And that evolved into your line of makeup, Boom. What makes Boom different?
Well, I tell you, women were approaching me almost on a daily basis and saying, oh, you're her, look, I'm growing out my silver hair because of you, you're because of my refrigerator, etc. And I realized women are ready for this. Women are ready to start celebrating their age. And when they saw me, a woman with silver hair and crow's feet, in fashion magazines, they suddenly got it.
Hey, Cindy, we're kind of losing you. I don't know if you walked out of the room or not, but if you can readjust yourself a little bit more. So Boom, I understand the attitude behind it, but how is it different? What should people do to look better at the age they are?
Well, basically, all you have to do is get happy.
Ah.
The happier you are, the more attractive you are. When a woman's having a good time, she is magnetic. And what I've noticed, being a makeup artist all my life and paying attention to skin tone, etc., I see what happens to the face. And when a woman is having a really good time, her skin revs up with color, it becomes dewy, kind of glisteny, and almost glimmery. There's a radiance there. So I wanted to create a cosmetic line that, first off, took all the mystery out of makeup. Pretty straightforward, plain and simple, multitasking little tubes called boomsticks, one for color, and this color works on all skin tones. And nobody believes me, but it truly does. I had 27 years to test it out on every skin tone there is. And it's for your lips, for your cheeks, forehead, anywhere that you naturally get color. And then there's Boomstick Glow, which is moisturizer in a stick. So when you're on the go, quick and easy, and you just want to add a little glow or, you know, little moisturizer to your skin, you can do it in a split second. And the other is Boomstick Glimmer, and that's where the radiance comes from. And that's it, including a wonderful overall body moisturizer.
All right, Cindy, give us a quick takeaway. What can we learn? What do you hope we all learn from your story?
Taking joy in living is a woman's best cosmetic.
Perfect. What a great way to end. And folks, you can learn more about Cindy and check out the complete Boom line of cosmetics at boombycindyjoseph.com. Thanks, Cindy. Up next, not only did he have to find his way through living with Asperger's, but find out what happened when he discovered his son had it too. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
Next segment is for anyone who's ever had the experience of feeling like there's something a little bit off, like you just don't quite fit in, that you're different than everybody else, and you can't quite put your finger on why. It's about a man with Asperger's who grew up in the 1960s before really anybody understood what that was. In fact, we knew very little about autism at all. But instead of being limited by it, he found a way to thrive, and today he's a well-known autism and Asperger's spokesman and best-selling author whose newest book, Raising Cubby, A Father and Son's Adventure with Asperger's, is really changing people's ideas of what this is all about. So let's say hi to John Elder Robison. Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, thank you for having me with you today.
Great to have you on the show, and first of all, thank you for standing tall and putting yourself out there as an example to other people. What couldn't have been an easy decision for you to make?
Well, it was unsettling at first, but then, you know, the more I did it, the more used to it I got, and it's pretty much okay now.
In a way, was it kind of therapeutic?
I don't think it was therapeutic. It was anxiety-provoking at first because I felt that people would, you know, read the stories and be critical or dismissive of me, or maybe attack me, but that proved to just be my own insecurity, and indeed people were inspired and encouraged by the stories.
Yeah, do you think that as a society, it seems like we're very interested in people who are different, who understand that and are trying to use their differences to better themselves, to become productive, and that's basically your story, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. And while it's easy to look back at it, you know, now and say, well, people do find it inspiring, it's certainly true that if you grow up and your father's, you know, an alcoholic, or, you know, you get, you know, beat up by, you know, somebody in your family, something like that, you often think that's a shameful secret and you don't tell anyone about it. And I think that I viewed my own upbringing in that light. So it took a bit of a leap for me to be able to actually speak about it.
Do you think that you would have done this had you not had a son with Asperger's? Do you think that was what kind of made you want to shout out to the world, hey, this is what we're like?
I think that what made me want to do that was the realization that I was empowered by understanding how I was different, and I knew that there must be thousands, if not millions, of young people growing up just like me, and I felt that they could benefit from knowing what I didn't learn until middle age.
Were you surprised, John, watching your son grow up with the disease, with what his differences were and the struggles that he went through to try to find his place?
Well, first of all, it's not a disease. It's a neurological difference. And when my son was growing up, we were not aware that he was different in the same way as me, because I didn't learn about my own Asperger's until my son was in second grade.
Wow.
However, when my son was growing up, I was able to see him have the same social struggles that I had as a little boy. And so I recognized him as having some same issues as me, but I had no name for them. When I learned about Asperger's in myself, I naturally thought, well, my son has some of those traits, but I didn't actually get a diagnosis for my son until he was 17 years old, just about.
Now, that's a great point to get into the story a little bit. I mean, you call him Cubby, and he was a brilliant chemist at the age of 17, but you tell the story about how his own creativity almost landed him in jail.
Well, that's right. Yeah, he became very interested in the physics of explosives and chemistry, and he would make, you know, videos of experiments, and he'd put them online, and, you know, and his videos never showed him damaging, you know, any property or doing anything bad, but the sophisticated conversations he had online, I think, were alarming and unsettling to some of the authorities in today's climate of fear.
Yeah, and they weren't so sure that he wasn't a terrorist. You know, when you tell the story, I'm sure you get a chuckle from people, but that had to terrify you.
Well, I think what happened was my son's explanations were so sophisticated that the ATF people looked at what he said, and they were convinced there was an adult with an advanced knowledge of explosives chemistry that was posing as a child to pass on lessons, as it were. And I think they were as surprised as anyone to discover there was nothing more to the story than a 16-year-old kid who used his allowance money to go to the hardware store and buy common chemicals and make them into these things.
You know,
I think, frankly, they were shocked at that.
He's very, very clever and very smart, just like his dad. You were a high school dropout, but you excelled in electronics, and you even created signature guitars for the band Kiss?
That's true, yeah. I left home and I joined a band, and I worked for progressively larger bands until I was hired by a sound company that Pink Floyd had founded to lease their sound gear out when they weren't on tour, and that was how I met the folks from Kiss. And so, yes, I'm known for having made those things.
John, what made you first start thinking that, well, maybe I should get tested for Asperger's too?
Nothing, actually. I had no idea of it, and I left electronics because I couldn't fit in larger companies, and when I started my car business, I got to know some of our clients here, and one of them was a therapist who, after observing me for a few years, he came in one day and said, you know, you could be the poster boy for this condition, and he handed me a book on it, and it was the most striking revelation for me to learn that.
John, what do you wish we understood about Asperger's?
I wish that we understood that when people behave in inappropriate or unexpected ways, that most of the time when that happens, the people haven't got a clue to what's gone wrong. And I think rather than being judgmental and immediately assuming that the person is out to get you, I think that we would all benefit from extending some compassion and maybe the benefit of the doubt when people behave in unexpected ways.
And how is Cubby doing these days? You know, he's an adult.
Well, he ultimately triumphed, as readers saw in the book, and Cubby's continuing his studies at the university, and he's working on a project called Open Chem Lab to create a automated open source chemistry lab system so that the fruits of chemistry would be within reach of anyone, just as you know, computers make it possible to do all sorts of analyses where you may not know the underlying math, but you can still get the results. You know, you don't have to be an engineer to benefit from the computer. And he wants to do the same for chemistry.
But, you know, the contributions from people with differences of all kinds in our society really are the fabric of what make us great. And in your first two books, Be Different and Look Me in the Eye, these are fascinating and important reads, as is his latest called Raising Cubby. He is a one-man warrior for autism and Asperger's understanding. His name is John Elder Roberson. John, thanks so much for the visit. Up next, a frank, honest, and maybe a little bawdy look at dating over the age of 50. This is Growing Bolder. Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts. Schaefer and Growing Bolder back with you, ready to introduce you to someone whose voice may be familiar as a longtime NPR commentator on All Things Considered. She's one of those people who seems to be able to laugh even during the toughest times, and she has had a few of those. But she was a columnist for Ladies Home Journal, writing teacher at the University of Baltimore. You've seen her on The Today Show, Politically Incorrect, and even Oprah. Her stories of being middle-aged and single are all these things: hilarious, reflective, honest, and quite helpful, especially her latest. It's a romp through the good and bad of life alone called Highs in the Low 50s, How I Stumbled Through the Joys of Single Living. Let's get a different perspective from Marion Winnick. Hey, Marion, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Hey, what's it like to be out there in the dating world when you're over 50?
Well, it's a little rocky, as I documented in my book.
Yeah, it's different, though. It's rocky in a different way than, you know, I'm sure you can ask any 20-something-year-old also, and they'll tell you it's kind of rocky, but it's a tougher in a lot of ways now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, first of all, the pool is much smaller. a lot of people, you know, have paired up and are off the market for good, yeah. Though some are always coming back on. You know, and even more than that, people have much more baggage than they had in their 20s and a lot more history. And in some ways, it's more like looking at people and finding out what you can't put up with rather than actually going out with a, you know, wish list and checking things off.
Well, let's go back a little bit to kind of set the story up. Can you talk a little bit about losing your husband and dealing with that and having to move on in the aftermath?
Oh, well, you know, I've lost two husbands now. I was widowed in my 30s, which was kind of tough. Then I was a single mom for a while. Then I met my second husband, and that was great for about 10 years. And then it ended in not so great, and divorce in 2008. Mm. And by then we had had another kid, so I had kids that were off at college and a little girl. And we were living way out in the country, and I kind of saw that my prospects for just about everything were limited in the country. So I moved to the city of Baltimore, where I already worked as a writing teacher at a college. And the second I got here, you know, I kind of launched into thinking that things were just going to go great right away. And I first looked in my, you know, around my immediate neighborhood and ended up dating a construction worker who was remodeling my basement, who actually was an illegal immigrant from El Salvador and barely and didn't speak English. So I was very open-minded, as you can see.
Yeah.
But I went on to have many, many different experiences, including a neuroscientist from Johns Hopkins.
Ooh.
So I wasn't limited only to the non-English speaking pool. And it just seemed like everything was a funny story, but nothing was, you know, true love and romance that I had been thinking of.
Do you sort of look at the watch and do you feel that the more pressure with each date to try to make something work, or do you get more frustrated?
No. I mean, I felt almost less pressure because as it went on, I started realizing this is just not like it was when you were in your 20s and 30s. And, you know, these rituals of dating and mating are quite different when you're older. And so the more it went on, the more I became a little more jaded and realizing that, you know, this might not be as easy as I thought it was going to be. So I had some fun and I met some nice people, but it just, it started to make me feel that I was looking, that I was seeking something that wasn't even maybe necessary, because I was realizing that so many things in my life were already great. I already have all these kids and these friends and this job and a really nice dog. And the more these bad dates went on, the more I started thinking, wow, you know, do I really have to do this? And I guess, you know, that's the story of the book, is me sort of concluding that while I'm not giving up for good, being single at my age is actually pretty rewarding and much more doable than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago, I think.
We should make clear, too, you didn't try to shoulder everything on your own. You did go to therapy, which a lot of people choose to do, and that kind of revealed some interesting things to you, too.
Right. Well, the therapist had me write down everything I was looking for in a man, and then she went over it and looked at me and said, "Marion, I think you want to date yourself."
Because, don't we,
you know,
all?
All right, everything I wanted, I want someone who loves movies and loves books and loves miniature dachshunds and, you know, loves to eat and loves to drink. And it was just me that I had described.
Hey, what's wrong with that?
Well, it's a little, you know, looking for such a tight blueprint doesn't always work as well. And I have to say that some of the relationships that worked out the best, and several of them have turned into long-term friendships, actually, were with people that were nothing like me. So I have to say that this, like, wish list thing wasn't the greatest on earth. And that kind of gives a bit of meaning to the online dating situation, where people are saying, "I am like this, and I want this," and then, you know, trying to match up with your missing puzzle piece or something.
So, Marion, while you were looking for that guy, do you kind of feel like maybe, you know, since you were in Baskin-Robbins, having all 31 flavors turned out to be a better deal than just finding, you know, vanilla?
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Okay.
I mean, it was rocky, and there were times I didn't have many big heartbreaks, but there were a couple situations that were sad, and, you know, I was really sad that they didn't work out. A lot of the time it was more just icky because I felt really bad about having to tell someone that, you know, that wasn't working out for me, or just the whole scenario of getting things started and then realizing they weren't going to work out is very hard.
Yeah.
Emotionally, and I couldn't stand it, actually.
It's not fun.
I hated walking into that coffee shop and taking one look and going, "Oh, no," you know, and then trying to figure out, how am I going to get out of this? And sometimes I didn't get out of it too, you know, easily.
So how are you doing now? Where are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, actually. I feel, like I said, sort of previewed, that I have found that single living is not a disastrous emergency that must be remedied as soon as possible. So I've developed a much more relaxed attitude about the whole thing, and did have a pretty fun relationship for the earlier this year that also didn't work out. Mm-hmm. But I you know, that counseling that people always tell you, when you stop looking, things start happening. Well, I wouldn't go that far, but it has been much better to get off the hunt. I've definitely called off the hunt.
Marian, you are so fun to talk to, and the book reads the same way you talk. It's just light. It's fun. There's things people will relate to all the way through the book, and that's, it's sharing a story that many, many people are going through these days. It's called Highs in the Low 50s, and you can learn more about it and its compelling author at Marian Winick. That's MarianWinick.com. Thanks, Marian.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it, craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Stop trying to define people by their age alone. It's a whole new world out there where it's not about age, it's about attitude, and that's Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.